If you were a grizzly bear, what would you want your diet to consist of?
If I was a grizzly bear, I'd want my diet to be varied and to be wild. I'd want it to come from every part of the landscape. You know, everything from the things you find along creeks to the insect colonies at the tops of mountains. I'd want to eat everything that this beautiful wild place has to offer.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Bryce Andrews about his nonfiction book, Down from the Mountain, The Life and Death of a Grizzly Bear. Don't go away. This book concerns Millie, the grizzly bear who comes down from Montana's Mission Mountains, which is a range south of Flathead Lake in the northwest corner of the state. And early on in the book you write, to my way of thinking, there are two kinds of mountains in Montana, those that still contain grizzlies and those that have lost them. What's the argument you're setting up here?
I suppose that one of the things I'm getting at is that the landscape, particularly the wild, undeveloped landscape of our mountain ranges, feels entirely different when we have this high-order, dangerous, difficult carnivore in them from when they don't. And for me, to have every species there, particularly the grizzly, it matters. We have, I think, an obligation to try to maintain populations in places where they can still survive.
And at one point in the book, you visit a wildlife rehabilitation facility, and you talk with a manager named Lisa, and you ask her how you can help, and this is what she says. I don't know what you can do to help, except get the word out. A famous bear has a better chance than one nobody knows about. Famous bears are harder to kill. So why was Millie a good subject for the book, and can you tell us a bit about her story?
Certainly. Millie is a good subject for a book because her story, which is simple and is particular to her, is really a microcosm for a lot of what's going on in the American West right now. She has an interesting story. She was a bear born in the Mission Range, grew up using every corner of that landscape, eating wild foods, crisscrossing the landscape in these amazing ways that grizzlies do. But she was drawn out of that pattern and into another one because of encountering a field of corn next to the base of the mountains. So Millie's story, in many ways, is about how this collision between the domesticated and the wild landscapes that we have here in our state plays out in the life of an animal, and what that means for her chances of survival, what that means for the details of her day-to-day life, and how that puts her in conflict with the people living on this landscape.
And in terms of the trajectory of the book, we find you building an electric fence to keep grizzlies out of this cornfield. And I wanted to know what you meant when you wrote, bears treat fences differently.
Well, I meant something really practical. So I went to work for People and Carnivores a few years ago, and it's an interesting small conservation group that basically works on all of these practical projects aimed at reducing conflict between people and large predators. And, you know, that's how I found my way to the cornfield, and that's how my story crossed with Millie's and where this book comes from. What I meant when I said that about fences is that grizzly bears have a really unique way of exploring the world. They have these fantastic senses of smell. They have a lot of, like, really formidable physical attributes. But they're also, they approach a fence in a way that allows you to turn them, to exclude them from a field or a piece of land using an electric fence while still letting other wildlife move through. So, you know, a bear approaches a fence differently in that if it's electrified and if they touch it with their nose, they almost always get turned back by it. If it's barbed wire or literally anything else, they'll find a way through. So it was this kind of unique way of approaching fences and the landscape that led me to think that we could do something interesting up at that cornfield.
One of the other fascinating parts as you're working on this fence is you stumble into what you call a labyrinth shaped by the hunger of bears. And just, you know, visually and sensually, can you describe that?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. So bears would come to this field to eat. And I think it's important for a listener to be able to picture what that looks like. So bears have this really cool way of eating corn. Depends on who you're talking to. If you're a corn farmer, not so cool. But they husk it and they eat it like we do. So they're actually like, you know, they take these paws with these huge claws on them, these paws that are strong enough to just break the spines of deer and elk with a swat, and they'll delicately husk this corn and eat the kernels. And they'll do that, like in this field, there were up to 16 bears, grizzlies, at a time. And that many bears can do a lot of damage. About 20% of this 90-acre cornfield was being knocked down by bears. And they would do it in interesting patterns. So what they would do is they would go in there, they would eat, they would stay in there, they would daybed in there, eat, and they would lay down these circles in the corn and then connect them with little pathways where they're moving through and knocking the stalks down. And you'd end up with this thing that was like basically the scariest but also most oddly beautiful labyrinth you could ever imagine. This series of like rooms and chambers and hallways cut through 8-foot tall corn. And to be in there, not advisable, by the way, but it was a really profound experience because you could see the physical manifestation of wild creatures colliding with the domestic crop. And that's something I think about all the time, both as a rancher and a conservationist. And to see it in the flesh like that, I mean, it's just really fascinating and made me want to tell the story.
There are pages that you dedicate simply to the essence of these bears, to the fear of stumbling into one. Why build tension like that?
I guess I don't feel like I had a choice in the matter. If I wanted to tell that story and tell it in a way that felt emotionally accurate, I was terrified a lot. Anyone who's working closely with bears and doesn't feel fear is missing something because of what they're capable of and how, you know, how fragile we are in comparison to them. There's something about being in a space like around that cornfield where you know that bears are there, but you can't see them, that imbues every moment, imbues your passage through the world with this kind of charged energy. And it's this sense that in a moment, things could either end in something wonderful, you know, seeing a creature that is rare anymore, you know, seeing a truly amazing animal, or it could end in disaster. And having that potential, that sort of dual kind of possibility, it makes everything feel different. It sharpens your senses and focuses you on the moment in a way that I think is profoundly important in the modern world, because we don't get very much of that.
I was hoping you would take us into one of the scenes. Will you read a passage?
Sure. So this passage picks up on the edge of this stand of corn once the crop has grown up. And it, you know, it's kind of crazy because corn, when it hits a certain stage of growth, it becomes so thick and tangled that it's like more like a wall than anything. And this passage happens as I'm working my way around the fence after bears have broken into this cornfield through the electric fence that I built. And it happens at the end of a few hours of working along that fence beside the field. The westward tipping sun burned hot and yellow. The day was windless, stifling. Grasshoppers kept up their maddening noise all around. Looking at the sun, I grew suddenly and painfully aware of my thirst. Distracted by all the bear sign, I had forgotten to drink at the truck or bring my water bottle. My tongue lay thick and rough in my mouth, and a thought came unbidden into mind. It was shady in the corn. There is a bear very near, my sober, faithful mind replied, and you cannot see. But the larger part of me didn't believe it, and I felt a strange, intense curiosity about the stand. Is it dark in there? I wondered. Cool? How will a breeze sound in the leaves? Starting through the alfalfa, I followed the line of beaten down stems in the direction of the stand. A wall of corn stalks drew near, stretching upward with every step. A bear, I said to myself, but the thought was overcome. I stood near the planting's edge, listening and watching with every fiber of my being. Where the trail entered the stand, a clump of flattened, blanched stalks protruded like a doormat or a tongue. Peering through a narrow opening in that wall of growth, straining my eyes against shadows, I could see the path widened into a small clearing. In that space, a circle 8 feet in diameter, the corn stalks had all been forced to the ground. They lay in whorls, and it seemed that the bear had worked methodically, leaving no standing foliage and precious few ears visible among the leaves and stems. A faint smell emerged, a scent like cut hay and simple flowers. Strangest, though, was the light. With the sun bright in the west and few clouds in the sky, rays caught the leaves and spread a soft green glow throughout the stand. Wanting to feel that cool light, I stuck out my suntanned hands. As if I were an orchestra conductor marking time, a noise began. Leaves rattled, and stems shook as though a whirlwind was blowing through. Heart leaping into my throat, I jumped backward and fumbled for my bear spray, wrestling the canister off my belt, expecting a grizzly to emerge at any moment. I glanced down to slip the safety. 3 things happened then, one following so closely on the heels of the next that I was hard-pressed to order them. I looked down at my outstretched hand and saw with dismay that it held a plastic voltmeter rather than a can of pepper spray. A pair of ring-necked pheasants burst from the corn and flew off, gabbling. I heard the words, "Very near, and you cannot see." Walking out shaken, I reminded myself that many things could have flushed that pair of birds. Just my standing there could have put them up, but all the same I kept well away from the corn. Reaching the truck and climbing into the oven-hot cab, I took a long pull from my water bottle. The tremors in my hands kept the liquid in motion.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to Bryce Andrews read from his book, Down from the Mountain, The Life and Death of a Grizzly Bear. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There is a bear shooting in the book. And you write, "I know how natural it is to carry a gun when the stakes are high." How do you reconcile gun ownership when it comes to protection and predation, like hunting?
It's a really interesting question, and one that I've been thinking a lot about recently, because so much of the work that I've done has been in these corners of Montana, places even more remote than the Mission, where there are truly dangerous animals on the landscape, and there are legitimate reasons, like putting down a cow that's been wounded, for actually carrying a firearm. And I do hunt, too. Yet, increasingly, I can't avoid looking at and thinking about the pernicious quality of gun culture and gun ownership in our state and in the West. You know, so there are 2 ways I can think about this. One is in the general sense. And when I think about it in the general sense, I think, well, it's very clear that we have too many guns and that I have as well. When I think about it for in specific situations, like with grizzlies in this field, I'd say 2 things. One, I don't carry a gun in grizzly country anymore for bears. I carry pepper spray, and it's statistically more likely to save your life in a bear encounter than a pistol is. That's proven. On the other hand, I do understand that a gun is a tool like any other. An old rancher told me that once. He said that the problem is when people stop treating them like tools. Millie, in this story, she gets shot under really mysterious and somewhat sketchy circumstances, but she's also put down with a rifle by the tribal wildlife biologist in what I consider to be one of the purest acts of mercy that appears in this book. So I guess I think it's complicated. I want to think more about it, but I'm very well aware of this human impulse that we all have, which is to reach for anything that we think can offer us safety in a terrifying situation. And bears almost always present us with a terrifying situation. And when people have weapons on them, they're so much more likely to use them. And so I guess to me, one of the important things is to look at the options and to look at how you know, what you set yourself up to do based on what you bring with you when you go into the woods. I think that's a really important thing.
You've brought up another important point, which is the land that this is on is indigenous land. What did it mean for you to be working on the reservation, and what do you think made it unique in that respect?
So this book does take place on the Flathead Indian Reservation, which is the home of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. And a lot of the work that I did up at the dairy with the corn and with these bears was done collaboratively with the Tribal Natural Resources Department. And I'd say a couple things about working on the reservation. One is that I was profoundly impressed by what a tribe is able to do in terms of grizzly conservation. You know, they set aside an entire chunk of the Mission Mountain Range that people don't even get to go into. That's something that we don't have the political or social wherewithal in the you know, like larger U.S. Western society to do. But the tribes had the guts and the discipline to do it. And that policy has borne incredible fruit in terms of grizzlies surviving, increasing in numbers, and beginning to expand into places where we all want to see them on the landscape. So we have a lot that we can learn from the tribes and a lot that we can thank them for. You asked me what it meant to work in that landscape and with the culture of the tribes up there. And I guess one of the things it does is it contextualizes my experience as an inhabitant of the American West. Because when I first came here, I looked at fourth and fifth generation ranching families, and I thought that that was a deep history. And it feels deep, and it's an intimate history with land, but it's a very short story compared with the story of the tribes. And I think that's a really important thing for those of us who practice agriculture in the West to keep in mind. So working on the reservation, I think, is good because it causes me to re-examine my own role here on the landscape and contextualize the world of agriculture that's been such a, you know, a home for me professionally and personally since I've lived here.
At one point, you take an apple to two cubs that you visit in captivity, and the cubs are eventually relocated to a zoo in Maryland, where you talk about wanting to send them elk meat from their home. And I want to know two things. Did you actually send them elk meat? And what is it about wanting to provide them with local food sources for you?
Well, I haven't yet been able to send them elk meat. And it turns out that that's actually somewhat more complicated than I anticipated it being, due to regulations about moving it around, and also the fact that occasionally I run into folks both in the Tribal Natural Resources and at Fish, Wildlife, and Parks who look at something like that as, I guess, you know, to put it bluntly, a useless symbolic gesture and one that is not worth their time helping out with. It's not out of the question, though. I'll go hunting this fall and we'll see. Why did I want to do that? I guess I wanted to do that because for me, as somebody who grows food and raises animals in this landscape, I realized that what we eat is a direct way of being tied to the land. And I guess I like to think that there might be something in the taste of an elk from this landscape, the smell of an apple that comes from the woods that these cubs were raised in, that might somehow comfort them in the existence that they know now. And I would say this about the zoo. I went down there and visited the cubs there, and it was a really difficult thing for me to see because I knew what their lives were like before, and I could see right in front of me what their lives had become in spite of the best intentions and the best care that people could give them in that context. It breaks my heart when an animal like a grizzly cub is taken out of the wild, but I also do understand the value of having bears in places where people can connect with them. And so this is something I keep going back to is, you know, is it better or worse for those cubs to be in a zoo? And as I see it, it's a really hard question to answer from their perspective because, you know, the lives that they have in captivity are just categorically different from what they had in the wild. But from our perspective, I think it is better to have some grizzlies in places like that because when I was there at that zoo, you know, there was a woman who walked up to me and described the fact that she essentially said, like, this, my child here. She had her child by the hand, and she said, this is the way that he can come to connect with and to love nature. We wish we could come to Yellowstone, but it's just not in the cards for us. You know, it's too long of a trip, and we don't have the money, and this is what he has to be able to understand all of it that's out there that you live with. And that's a really hard thing for me to, I wouldn't want to deny that to people, because I think it leads them to good action and maybe to be moved to care and act on behalf of species like the grizzly.
I'm thinking about my favorite scene in the book is when you come to a big box store in Missoula and petition one of the workers for some plastic pallets. And it's this beautiful collision of your compassion and your plea and also encounters with the layman. So can you describe for listeners a bit about how you talk about your work with random people?
Yeah, so the scene you're talking about, I was cruising Reserve Street, which is our big, you know, local embarrassment and strip mall. I was driving around and I was trying to find these plastic pallets because I had this idea that I could put electrified wires on top of them so that bears couldn't walk in over these pivot sprinkler crossings that were letting bears into the field. So I had this idea for like a crazy tool, but I needed these things. And I remember going all over town and being told no in various places and finally coming to the back end of a box store, which will remain completely nameless, and encountering this guy who had very clearly been changed by his work, dulled by his work. And at first he was really reluctant to talk to me. He thought I sort of had a crazy idea, but you could tell that there was some resonance. He resonated with my description of the bears in the field. And I remember it was just kind of touch and go, but all of a sudden he sort of, something clicked in him, and he had this light in him all of a sudden where he was talking about bears, he was thinking about them, and we basically ended up with this arrangement by which I could have these pallets, which was, I would say, ad hoc. What really struck me about it was that if you can find a way to tell a story like this and that allows people to rekindle what most of us have at some point, which is this deep and essential connection with wild creatures and wild places, if you can resurrect that, people are willing to stretch the bounds of what they think they can do to help. And in some ways, that's the heart. I'm glad you recognize that scene. I'm glad you mentioned that scene, because in some ways, that's the heart of why I write things like this, is because I mean, there is a little bit of an activist sentiment in me strained through this lens of personal experience. And I want to figure out a way for me to talk about stories like this in a manner that allows people to connect and leaves the door open to action. I don't want to push people toward it because I don't think that really works very well, but I wouldn't have had that equipment to use if that guy hadn't felt some connection to those bears and the place and if he hadn't wanted to help in that way. So it was important to me that he did.
To me, this book read as part elegy and part allegory, or like you said, sort of a microcosm of a bigger movement. And I was really reaching for the subtext because I kept thinking, this isn't just about Millie the Bear. And it came to me at the end that what you are writing about is what you call our epidemic lack of restraint. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by epidemic lack of restraint is this. I have worked in, as I said, the sort of wilder corners, the less developed corners of Montana, for most of my adult life. I mean, really for all of my adult professional life. And what I notice is that everywhere I've been, the wild spaces contract, the built spaces expand. And if you look at the history of settlers in the West, of, you know, Manifest Destiny and this massive influx of people who really didn't understand the place very well, one constant from generation to generation is that we leave it less intact than we found it. And I chalk that up to an epidemic lack of restraint. I mean, you think about the way that, here's an example, right? A family on a farm over three generations, and each generation has two kids. And at the end of those three generations, the farm has six houses on it. You follow that through another three generations, and we will lose the landscape that we all love. And it's really hard to make that case, right? Because you look at the mother and the father wanting to give something to their children, wanting, paradoxically, to give them a connection to the land that was so important to the older generations. Yet we've come to the point where we have to start making harder choices about what we do with landscape and how we preserve the integrity of the parts of this place that make it so important to all of us who live here. So I guess I worry about our lack of restraint, and I consider this a really important moment to begin to change the way we do that, up to and including being the first generation to leave this landscape more intact and therefore less built than we found it.
Maybe you've just answered this, but the book also feels as much to me about where grizzlies belong in the landscape as it does about where you belong in the world. How do you reckon with your own sense of belonging?
That's a hard question, because I always wanted to be in places where I didn't belong socially. You know, I grew up in the progressive heart of Seattle and decided to move and live in, for the most part, extremely conservative ranch communities in Montana. And so because of politics and upbringing, but also just because of the way small towns often work, I was always sort of an outsider, even though I was doing the work upon which so much of the mythology of those communities is built. And that's been a really interesting experiment and experience. My wife, Jillian, and I now live on a farm. We own a farm that's in the town of Arlee, which is on the Flathead Reservation. We are living within the boundaries of a sovereign nation on private land that exists because of basically unjust policies in the past. And so it causes me to think a lot about what belonging is and who gets to be where on the landscape. And I haven't fully reconciled or come to a conclusion about that, except to say that one thing that seems true to me wherever you go is that good people respect good work. And that if you want to live anywhere, whether it's Arlee or whether it's Missoula or downtown Seattle, you have to contribute to your community. There is no other path to belonging, as I understand it. So I guess what that means is that it makes me want to know my neighbors better. It makes me want to figure out ways to increase the integrity and happiness of every community that I'm in. And I hope that translates to belonging rather than alienation. I hope it does.
Bryce Andrews lives on a farm in northwest Montana. His debut book, Bad Luck Way, was winner of the Barnes & Noble Discover Award and the Reading the West Book Award. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.